Willkommen beim Wonderful Podcast, Living Yoga off the Mat. Ich bin Wanda Badwal. Ich freue mich, gemeinsam mit dir die faszinierende Welt des Yoga, der Spiritualität und persönlichen Weiterentwicklung zu erforschen. Zu hören und zu erfahren, wie wir mehr Liebe, Balance und Erfüllung in unserem täglichen Leben integrieren können. Willkommen bei Wonderful. Schön, dass du hier bist. Hey, you guys, and welcome to this week's podcast. I'm so glad you're here. And as you notice, I'm speaking English, which is why I have an international guest on the show. And I'm so, so excited to introduce to you the guest, Tara Judell. So Tara is an internationally well-known yoga facilitator. She's the co-creator of the yoga style called Embodied Flow. She's a writer, she's a change agent, and she's probably one of the funniest people I know. And on top of that, she's one of my dear, dear teachers. And I'm so, so glad I got to talk to her during our teacher training here in Greece. And what we're going to talk about in this week's podcast is how it is actually to create a complete new yoga style. Imagine, isn't that amazing? Like, imagine there wouldn't be vinyasa flow, there wouldn't be Iyengar yoga, there wouldn't be Ashtanga, all of that wouldn't be there, and you just create something completely new. So really inventing something, a yoga style, and which is called embodied flow, and which draws from different practices, different traditions, such as Anusara Hatha yoga, the tantric tradition, the tantric philosophy, psychology, and the practice of body-mind centering, which is a practice of getting into your feeling, sensing body. It's a somatic practice in order to expand your awareness, really. And all of that practices and traditions, she and her partner, Scott Lyons, who I will also get the chance to talk with, and this podcast coming up soon, guys. So they created this complete new yoga style. So I get to ask how it actually happened that they created this style, which is super interesting, I find. Then we also talk about flow. What does that actually mean? Flow state. We hear this quite often, right? What is Tantra? Really getting to the foundation of what is Tantra. And Tara also shares with us what keeps her inspired. So being a yoga facilitator, she's holding lots of retreats, trainings around the world, and she's constantly traveling. So what is her own practice to stay inspired and to get feedback? And that is really interesting to me too. And then also in the end, we will sing a little mantra. She will also guide us into a sweet meditation. So getting a taste of Tara's style of teaching. So it's a really, really amazing interview. I really loved this talk with her, and I hope you will enjoy it as I did. So enjoy, Tara Judell. Okay, welcome to the podcast, Tara. I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So my first introductory question is, what moves you right now? I know it's a big one.
Now in this moment, now in my life.
Everything.
What moves me? I am moved by presence, authenticity, group mind, embodying formlessness form, and finding my liberated embodied self and everything she desires. And I think love is moving me a lot right now.
Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, I think it's a big cocktail that's moving me. So I could probably go on in a list, but that feels, those feel like the main events. Mm.
So we are here in Paros right now in Greece, mm-hmm. and we're moving a lot, indeed. Like every day we're doing this 100-hour mind module. And to just name a brief overview of what you have done, I mean, you created this new style of yoga. So you're really a pioneer who created something completely new, so which is called embodied flow. Can you take us a little bit onto the journey of how you invented a complete new yoga style? Because I think this is really, yeah, it's amazing. It's courageous. It's, yeah. So
thank you. And I'm so glad you're a part of it.
Me too.
Yeah. I have been on quest for awakening and truth and peace, those things that I think put a lot of us in search. And I was in search for that before I met yoga for a while. When I finally fell into yoga in a yoga class around 97, immediately I fell in love, like probably a lot of us. Like there's the coming together of moving and breathing and feeling absence of thoughts and those things. Immediately I started taking yoga, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours a day, because I was a writer in Hollywood at the time, which meant I spent a lot of time procrastinating. And in the procrastination of writing things that I should have been writing, I was taking yoga classes endlessly, abundantly. And eventually went through teacher training. First day of teacher training was 9/11, September 11th, and it was a big...
Oh, wow.
Break from everything I had done before, or writing and directing, and to like, I can't do that anymore. And not that I knew I would teach yoga, but I just knew I wasn't going back. So teaching became at first an escape and a passion and a compulsion. And the inquiry that I was holding and have been holding and still hold is how I'm offering the thing that I'm offering in the classroom, doing what I think yoga is about. So is the asana class, which is where most of us meet yoga, is it bringing people into yoga, which my understanding of is the felt sense of a unified space. And the school of yoga that I grew up in based itself in tantric philosophy, which I still believe is amazing and wonderful, and we teach and practice. But my feeling was that I was giving a lot of philosophical orientation and a lot of hard physical instructions, and they weren't actually coming together. It was a class, I was offering classes that felt passable, people liked them, they were popular. And at the same time, I was meditating a lot, but I couldn't find the feeling of meditation always in asana. And I felt that I was giving people a lot of things to do, a lot of alignment and a lot of fancy poses, but it almost started to feel like a distraction from the feeling that I knew was the feeling of unity. And how does that unity move when we move? How do we move in, you know, what we talk about now in embodied flow, mm-hmm. in a flow state? And so I just was sitting with the agitation of feeling the disparity of two things not coming together, this tantric philosophy that I was in love with and the asana that I was teaching and the meditation. Felt like I had different channels operating, and they weren't doing the thing that I was looking for anymore. And then I met the world of body mind centering, which is Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen's work, which is all about, I mean, her seminal work is sensing, feeling, action. That anything that is you, you could find inside. That's the sensing part. It involves a nervous system aspect, or the feeling part, which is tuning into having the relationship to, and then moving from that place. And there's some things that we talked a lot about in the yoga that I used to teach, like the heart and, of course, muscles and bones and different chakras and things like that. But there was so much else in our body that we weren't feeling into, or at least I wasn't. Mm. And so I started finding the person who introduced me to body mind centering, let me know that I didn't feel my spleen. And I thought, not only do I not feel it, I'm not even sure where that is or its function.
Where is it again?
Between your 9th and 12th ribs on the left side of your body, opposite the liver. And that sent me in about a 3-week journey to find it, which didn't come from looking hard. It didn't come from looking at books. It came from the moment that I backed away and it allowed itself to be known. And then once I had that contact, I was obsessed with finding everything else that is me. Mm-hmm. Because we have this suit we walk around in, and we know we talk about deep esoteric internal things, but not everybody is feeling what they are, what we actually are underneath the hood. And so it became really quickly clear to me that what I said to my friend is, I have to know about this. I have to know all of this. And she said, it's really going to ruin your teaching. And I said, I don't care. And I can't care, because it's obviously what I felt when I moved into my spleen was something that pushed me more in the direction of the meditative field from my organ. So it let me know that actually anything inside of our body that is a microcosm of the macrocosm, and that's tantric. Mm. Everything that is us couldn't possibly be different from the felt sense of the field. So anything that is me could be a portal into the everything. And I felt that from my spleen. And then I felt that from my kidneys. And then I felt that from my liver. And then I became obsessed with finding it everywhere, which is what Bonnie and body mind centering have already done. That work exists. What I found, though, in moving into that field was that it didn't abundantly exist in yoga. It existed in places, in pockets, but that world was not inhabited by the same people that I was meeting every day in different yogic contexts. The feeling that I got when I went to body mind centering is, everybody should know this. How could we possibly be alive and not feel everything that we are? Mm. It seems at a certain point ludicrous. And the sense that I had was going from a 2-dimensional world to a 3-dimensional world, or a 5-dimensional, like, why shouldn't we have all the colors and all the dimensions, or from black and white to color? So I started with that, how can I get body mind centering into yoga? For me, I started just very soon experimenting with parts of that inside of the yogic context I had, which at that point was Los Angeles and a lot of different studios. And over time, I started to look for a body mind centering practitioner that could offer inside of trainings that I was doing. I had already started to shift how I was teaching and using the somatics in order to get us, to jumpstart us into flows. And then I met Scott Lyons, mm-hmm. In a body-mind centering course. And then he and I started a dialogue about combining tantric philosophy, asana, somatics, psychology, and many different movement modalities, free movement, into a compendium of things that became embodied flow. And that's really, I mean, so the inquiries that we hold with embodied flow are how do we become these liberated embodied beings, these Jivan Muktis, and how can all of the technologies, all of the methodologies provide a felt sense into the slipstream of awakening? So not just meditation, but all these different portals inside of our body, and not just feeling them, but moving from them, which gives us agency or choice around them.
Thank you. So I'm really curious, like in the practical way, how did it look like? Did you guys really meet up in a room and said, okay, let's try this exercise, or let's like do breathing into our heart together? Or how did you really start to create this process?
Yeah. The first thing that we did was in a 300 hour, I had him teach the first 100 hours and somebody else, two other teachers, teach the mind and expression modules. And before we got to that training, I mean, I had deep faith that he had practices, and so we met in New York City, and he, you know, we co-created an outline, and then we co-created principles that we felt passionate about, not the principles that we have now, but just things that are important. And you know, I'm kind of a, like, try it, throw it up against the wall. So I would say that I trusted him a lot in the first program, that I, you know, that we would have a sequence that moved through the 10 days as a journey through the body. And then we talked about the thematic way we would bring that together. And then we did it. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot on the spot. And I would say in the first iteration of it, I was bringing in the bits I knew, and he was bringing in the bits he knew. And over time, as we, you know, as I participated in thousands of hours of his classes and he with me, the dialogue became much richer and more interactive. And so starting to share and play with more and more practices, and then also refine the manuals and create what are the principles now, which was, you know, I think months and months of conversation and debate and rewriting. Imagine. Yeah. So I think it arose pretty organically. And then now we, you know, now we try things out and say, what do you think? Does this work? Does this work? Yeah.
I'm so happy you guys met.
Me too.
It's like match made in heaven.
Yeah. I mean, it's funky. We bring really different things to the table. But I think, you know, I was obsessed for a time with a book called Strategic Intuition, which is all about flashes of insight. And one of the things that book says is that when two pre-existing things come together in a unique way, that's what innovation really is. And I think that's what I feel happened with me and Scott, is that, you know, the way of weaving the tantric philosophy into the asana with embodiment, plus BMC and psychology and all the different paradigms that he's bringing to the table, now osteopathy, it's creating something that hasn't quite been done before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. So embodied flow, for the ones who are listening, to repeat it again, and to also go a little bit into the different aspects. So it's a combination of body-mind centering, meeting yoga, meeting tantric philosophy, right?
Psychology. Somatics.
Mm-hmm. Science. So let's go into tantra.
Okay.
Like one of your favorite topics, yeah. as I know, and one of mine too. So let's talk a little bit about Tantra. So for the ones who've never heard about Tantra, what is Tantra?
The Tantra that I have studied is called Kashmir Shaivism, which is a northern-based tantric school. In a nutshell, Tantra is a technology and it recognizes, it's called a non-dual philosophy, which means that everything is made of one thing. In modern day terminology, we could say the unified field. It's all one field that appears in these different densities and frequencies. And the desire of the tantrikas in their origins, which is around 6th century Common Era, was for this, in this human body that seems somehow densed, separate than this field, or what we could call the divine, limited in power and intelligence and capacity, how can this body be my doorway to the experience, the felt sense of the infinite? And I think it probably started from experience and then became the philosophy, as most philosophies do. There's an experience of the experience, and then there's the description of the experience. But the radical, we could say, step forward of the tantrikas was, one, that they eliminated an intermediary. There was no priest, no Brahmin, no Shaman. There's nothing in between you getting to the experience. You are the doorway to the experience. And therefore, anything in the world, anything that you focus your attention on, is a potential doorway into the macrocosm of infinity, but specifically in your human form. And the thing that Tantra recognizes is that this body is like a drop of water from the ocean of everything. It contains all the properties of the universe inside of this form. Therefore, everything I do is potentiates my experience of unifying or yoga-ing myself to an infinite realm, which, when the coverings or the veils or the obfuscations, the tantric tradition has many names for it, when they lessen, clear, or lift, what I actually am, the I am-ness that inhabits all of us, has almost unlimited capability, could have unlimited knowledge, could lack nothing, is full and complete unto itself, recognizes this infinite continuity that has manifested in the form of me, and is somehow beyond space and time, which I think we all have glimpses of all the time. It's the space between, it's the space before, it's the space after, it's those moments of things coming together, a this and a that, that seem like one thing. Which is why, you know, the popularized version of Tantra is sexual, because the idea of the moment of union between a male and a female imitates that moment of self-consciousness or limited self dissipating. Right. And most of my teachers would say most of the sexual tantric stuff is neo-tantra or something that has evolved in the last 150 years. But not to exclude it, nor to say it's that, because it's not, that's not my area of practice or expertise in that way. But that more so, everything that is knowable in the universe is knowable through the portal of myself, which is a wildly affirming and practical practice, because therefore what's happening in my mind screen is creating the reality my reality outside. In other words, however clear I am as an instrument or as a drop of the ocean, that is also how well I can perceive everything that is outside of me.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. I don't know if that's simple. In other words, the microcosm is part of the macrocosm. And an analogy I give a lot is that if a drop of water felt it was separate from the ocean, that would be ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
If you were swimming in the ocean and one drop says, no, I'm not a part of that, that would be silly. But that is what we as human beings do. Remembering that the aim of all of this is to alleviate our suffering first, and not only to alleviate suffering, but to invite in wild freedom, which is, from the tantric perspective, our birthright. The first sutra of the book called the Pratibhijna Hridayam, or the Pratibhijna means recognition, and Hridaya is the heart, is consciousness out of its unbounded freedom brings about the attainment of the universe. It is a free, but it's such a beautiful portrayal. It's such a free field, and it creates inside of us the capacity to attain that freedom. And the next sutra is, it creates itself out of itself. It creates itself, this consciousness, us, out of a part of itself. And I get this image of this ocean sort of forming forms out of itself, just like the creation myth of the Hindus. It's the clay, it's the paint, it's the canvas, it's all of it making itself out of itself. And then most of the rest of Tantra is obsessed with how we contract from a full, infinite, dynamic stillness into an individual self with all of these layers of an eye maker, a mind stuff, and cloaks and veils, and then how we move from that space wherever we are back into infinite freedom.
Yeah, that's actually what you're doing with your work, right? You taking away layers in this practices we do, and you, through the practices, connect us again and again with that infinite ocean. So for the people who are not here right now with us and can do embodiment practices, like, what would you say are like practical ways to tune into this infinite source?
Practical ways to tune into infinite.
I mean, you
source.
Can also guide us into it with a little meditation practice, if you like.
Yeah, let's do that. That would be easier, probably.
Yes.
Then.
So, guys, don't close your eyes when you're driving the car right now.
Yeah, if you're driving the car, don't do this and drive. So, if you're at home, or even if you're walking, or if you're driving. Driving, be careful. Just let your body meet and melt into the support beneath you. And you can let the back line of your body, this outline border of yourself, rest into the support or the space behind you. As you breathe into your lungs, letting the belly expand in the front and the sides and the back. Allow your head, the weightiness of your head, to slide back in space and slip its energy down through the vertebral column. As you soften your eyes behind your eyelids, if your eyes are closed, or you could have them softly open. Soften the space behind your forehead. Letting yourself arrive and settle. Now you could envision that the whole border of you, the skin which is permeable, as if there were thousands of tiny little nostrils on every pore of your skin. Breathing the outer space into the inner space as the inner space of your body swells and fills, expanding the interior. And on the exhale, envisioning the inner space spilling out through the edges of you. There's an intimate shape-shifting exchange between the outer space and the inner space through the permeable border. This inner space as you exhale is breathed in from the outer space, and as you inhale, the outer space exhales into you. All the sides, the spherical body, supported inside, embraced outside. This beautiful intimate exchange between the inner self, the outer self. And finding the find the outlines of your body now with your hands, just to bring yourself back into the physical outline of your body. Let your hands rub along the skin. You can bring your two hands together, palm to palm. Feeling the border of yourself meeting the border of yourself. Whatever taste or sip, the felt sense, the field of space itself. Record that in your inner mind's eye as you give a slight bow to yourself in gratitude for that moment of dropping in, tuning in. As you're ready, you can softly open your eyes.
Thank you. That felt like a bath.
It's a tiny bath, a short bath.
But it did its work.
The thing that I'm really coming to understand is that allowing the liquidity or permeability of what I hold myself to be lets me slip into the vastness of the field of I am-ness. And so I'm very interested now in practices that are letting the sense of my container expand, which I recognize for some people it's the opposite. Their sense of having a container is the thing that lets them be embodied. And one of the things Scott and I recognize is that perhaps some people's permeability or inability to perceive their own borders is something that is the challenge for them, because one of the paradoxes of Tantra is we are this and that. We are this continuity manifest in a capable, interactive body. We're not escaping the body. We're not interested in escaping the body. We're not escaping even this reality. We're interested in how do I become as choice-filled and adaptable in this reality, and also the most essential core self embodied in this body. So for some of us, that's more permeability. It's lessening the efforting or the dense walls or the thick habits or beliefs. And for others of us, it might be finding our body, finding our bones, or the power of our capacity to anchor ourselves in our, even where we meet the earth. Because we're really this two-way channel between the infinite realm of, we could call space, like outer space or cosmos, and this earth matrix. We're the channel between. And so Tantra has always been fascinated by that. How do I, as an individual drop of the ocean, actually bring the ocean here to this place and to my actions and to my interactions and to my creative output?
Yeah, totally. Like what I notice for myself, like what you also often refer to, is don't let the eyes pop out of your head. So this practice of keeping my eyes soft and actually let the world come to me rather than looking at the world. And that changed my world completely. Like that, we don't need to be ahead of ourselves.
When we say be with what is, with the current, to be with this beautiful word in Sanskrit, anugraha, to be with the getting, which translates as grace, to get it, to be, I mean, I'm hesitant to say to be with the flow because it's so overused, but it's really that there's a stream that's moving. Life is moving, and life is meeting us. And I want to be able to meet life without pushing to meet it head first or eyes first. And I also don't want to hang back, that it's coming at me and I'm head back, leaning away from it. And we call those things propping or collapsing. So if I'm using more effort than is needed for the situation, I'm not with it. And if I'm not using enough effort, I'm not meeting it. And we're looking for effortless effort, where there's this sustenance between the energy, this life force energy that's animating me, moving through my actions and meeting the environment and other self, other, and environment with that. Equanimity isn't exactly what I mean to say, but with my agency, my resources, and my knowledge with a capital K of what's really informing this. What is that mysterious source that's animating everything? And the tradition will say the only way to know that is through the meditative space, through that concentrative space where a sense of a limited I dissipates. And I think, right, the soft eyes or the soft focus eyes allows that individual self to soften into that field.
So you said it before, like the word flow is overused. So can you, from your perspective, define for us again, what is flow, and like when else do these meditative fields you just guided us into occur in our life?
Well, if we think of flow, I think the first visual that I look at is a stream, a river. And in our body, which is fluid and, you know, 70% fluid, one of the things we're looking at in our body is where is there flow? Where there's stagnation in our physical body, literally there is disease. So within our physical body, if it has both integrity and permeability and flow, it's in health. So one of the first things we're looking for is where is there flow here in our body? And then if you think of another thing that is from several different traditions is where awareness goes, energy flows. That's in, you know, Tai Chi as well as martial arts as well as Thai yoga. And we mirror the same. Where I can put my attention, I can awaken anything from a cell to groups of cells, which are tissues, to connections of tissues and systems. And my life flow, one thing we look at is an easefulness of moving from one thing to the next thing, being able to meet and be met by things in a moment-to-moment space. And so we're imagining that if samadhi or same mind, this equanimity of inner mind with big mind, that is the source of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, or the subject of what is that in action? What is meditation in motion? And that's what we feel flow is. It's a meditative state that is continuing from one moment into the next, eyes opened, walking around in movement. And those string of moments adds up into a river that is flow. And further than that is flow state, which is this state that I'm considering like the fourth state. It literally has a brainwave variation into a theta gamma brainwave state, so deeper brainwave states that create a sense of a loss of I individual eye a loss of self-consciousness or self-watching and emerging of that which you are doing, like doer and doing converge. And that's what we think of as flow state, which has been written about by Csikszentmihalyi in the book Flow, as well as other more modern authors around extreme sports and things like that. And our curiosity is, how can we move into flow state without extreme sport? And and maybe with the absence of something like painting or music, but just with our own bodies. And so that's something that we're looking at quite a lot. How, if in the tantric investigation, if this individual body is part of the macrocosm or the universal body, how can I access that to move into a continuity of flow?
Mm. You said the other day, how can I base jump in my own body?
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. All those things. Surf. How can I surf it? Base jump it. Paint it. All of it. Inside.
Mm.
Yeah. It's efficient tantra. Like, you just need this body that goes with you everywhere until you don't.
Did you actually ever base jumped or like bungee jumped?
I've jumped out of an airplane. Yeah, I've jumped out of an airplane.
How was that?
Twice.
Was it a flow state?
Not the first time. Because the thing they say about flow states is there's actually four phases in extreme sports. So the first phase in extreme sports is a struggle. And so one of the things that brings athletes into flow states is the struggle, which produces a lot of adrenaline and cortisol. Because they have a skill set that, because another thing that helps with flow states is if your skill set matches the activity and the activity is slightly above your skill set. So in the case of me jumping out of an airplane tandem, I had no skill set for that, no reference point for that, just maybe bravery or stupidity, depending on your perspective. So I would say the first minute that is free fall was this rush of adrenaline and cortisol coursing through my body. When the chute opens, you're just floating. And that part's more easeful, which is what in a flow state, an extreme athlete can kind of flip their brain state from the adrenaline cortisol into flow state, which has dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. So a chemical cocktail that's more peaceful and elevated and brings and accesses all of their skill sets. So the second time I jumped out of an airplane, also tandem, I think I was able to, having had the previous experience, stay more present for the free fall. And I would say there's something like a flow state in that, but for me, flow states happen definitely in while teaching, while writing, free movement, and asana. Like it's pouring myself into these things that are into a place where the limited thinking beta brain space is not online. It's not working. But I think people can experience flow states doing pretty much anything if they're pouring their awareness there. Mm. And that's, for me, that's the hope, is that what we're calling embodied flow provides practice ground to attune oneself into various layers of the body, into various, or, you know, in the mind, we look at more the construct of mind and how we might move past things that are potential blocks in the road of moving in flow. And hopefully all of those practices are leading up for the possibility for somebody from an embodied space to be able to find more agency and to find more flow in anything they do.
Thank you for this explanation. I ask a little bit around our group of yoga teachers. We hear like what interests them, and also yoga teachers listening to this podcast. So another question I have for you is, like, you teach a lot. You know, right now you give 300 hours, 10 days after another, and you have a lot of, like, you give a lot, right? So how do you keep yourself inspired? What is your self-care? Not only, you know, maybe getting a massage, but also on the mental level, like, do you have a mentor? Do you, like, what do you do as your resources as a teacher?
I think, well, it's changed a lot over the years. So different, I would say different things at different times. I have mentors for sure. Sally Kempton is one. Bonnie Bainbridge is one. I believe in counsel. I believe that you need to have several people around you that are your sadhana brothers and sisters, that are their job. My counsel's job is to call me out on when I'm not being true to myself. So they're kind of more than friends. That's my requirement, is that I have several people that I really, our dedication to each other is that we hold each other's highest self in our purview. And they have been doing similar practices to me, next to side by side, and we really hold each other to task to kind of root for each other's best self. I passionately pursue wherever my curiosity takes me, which usually, there's definitely always something that is teaching me something new. Right now I have Bonnie Bainbridge's new book, Neurocellular Patterning and Embryology. I may have gotten one of those words incorrect. I love information. I try to keep learning something new all the time. I mean, next year I'm really excited. I'm going to study with Judith Blackstone, her process, the realization process. I try to create new things. Like all of that is kind of mental stimulus. In terms of the continuity of having many different events and traveling around the world, I also really believe in creating boundaries with people. That's something, as a yoga facilitator, it took me really a long time to figure out that I have more to give if I don't answer every person after class, if I set up my own container for experience. So these are the time, like, I will give everything inside of the room and outside of the room. I have to limit my social time, limit dinner conversations, mm-hmm. limit extra things, and that I make as a necessary part of my self-care routine, alone time, time to myself, time to replenish, time to do nothing, time that, you know, absorb time, rest time is productive time, and not that I need to fill every moment with doing something, mm-hmm. because there's diminishing returns. I'm learning to really make time for a relationship, to make time for playing with the dog, walking on the beach, and also to not just self, obviously practice, but also to continuously look at things even that I've looked at before, like sutras, and walk around in it, marinate in it, understand it from now, to keep the aliveness of what it is that we're doing, and also to cut yourself a break, like to recognize that we're human. And you know, I think that sometimes people have a rigorous perfectionism as yogis that is also not the permeability of nature's nature. It's not actually what people are. So they have an idea that yogis eat only this, do only this. It's an ascetic routine that's potentially not sustainable. So there's kind of, I also just have a real compassion and forgiveness for doing things that I really wish to do, that I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you watch Netflix sometimes?
All the time. Are you kidding?
What's your favorite show?
Oh my gosh, currently. I just finished. Current, it's not current, but I just currently finished Orphan Black, obsessed. Yeah.
I have to check that out.
It's so good. It's 5 seasons. I mean, I watched everything. What are you talking about? Fleabag, Peaky Blinders. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is my new hero. Killing Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Can I look them all up?
That's a really good list I just gave, by the way. Of everything I've said, that's probably the most important thing.
People love this kind of stuff, you know? It's like,
I mean, I was a filmmaker before I was a yoga teacher, but it's truly an antidote for me, because we get so enmeshed in the world of training. And like you said, I do 200-300s a year. I do 200. I'm traveling, doing immersions and that. And I love diving into an alternative world, but also because my background is in writing and theater, and that, like, it also stimulates my writer self and my visual self, and yeah, that. But it has to be good writing, mm-hmm. or I won't do it.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Another question about teaching yoga. I had a funny moment, I think yesterday, with a Swami. Here's another group here at the retreat center, and I had a brief conversation with him, and he said, the thing about, like, the most used word in the world right now is yoga, and the most misunderstood word is yoga. And he said, like, the difficulty with asana is that it creates big egos quite often. And that was his, you know, like, take on it. And what interests me is, like, what would you say are, let's say, the shadow sides or dark sides we have to watch out for as a yoga teacher?
I didn't know that Swami said that. I agree. I think there are all kinds of pitfalls. You said as a yoga teacher?
Yeah, or yogi, like in general.
I think spiritual materialism is the biggest pitfall. And that means that I disavow myself of a previous ego for this new ego that is my yoga spiritual self ego. And, you know, the world of social media and the way, I mean, I find it amazing how many selfies are taken in meditative poses. Like, who? And I'm sure I have a few meditative poses that obviously I didn't take the picture, but it's there's something about the irony of the combination of these things, that we're practicing yoga to experience the self and taking selfies of the self, practicing yoga to experience the self. It's a crazy hall of mirrors. And I think, you know, the poses, the asanas, I mean, we've said this in class, they're the last iteration of the yoga journey, or one of the last. And so I think they're a great way to physicalize and to create containers to explore consciousness. The challenge is that people get obsessed with the goal of the pose itself, and the goal is not the end game. No, there's no correlation between advanced asana and advanced yoga. And I think this is the thing that if I were learning about yoga simply from looking at Instagram, I would never understand what it's about. And so the exterior forms of all of it have become a little bit of a circus, and a lot like gymnastics and calisthenics and other things. And those things will make you feel healthy, and they will prepare your body in some ways for more strength and more flexibility. The challenge is that, yeah, there can be, look what I did. But the other thing is that it can also create a competitive culture, which has nothing at all to do with what the aim of yoga. So when I see people go to classes and look at what other people are doing, or comparing themselves, looking, you know, or think that they'll be great once they get this pose or that handstand, it mortifies me, because it's the same way humans beat themselves up in comparative ways around other things. And this to me has very little to do with the big aim of yoga. So it's like we've taken a capitalistic culture and poured over yoga and created in it something else that is strangely competitive or posh or, I don't know, looks good. And none of that, of course, is the territory. So I believe in the potency and the power of yoga so much that I think if anyone sticks around if longer than a few years and is really curious, they'll sift through that layer. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of this mayic illusory threshold that one must go through until they find the deeper teachings, I would imagine, if one's entering now. I mean, the mm-hmm. world has changed. The yoga world has changed so much in the past 20 something years that it's very challenging to keep up with how it's constantly transmuting.
Thank you. So don't take selfies of yourself.
You can take selfies.
Do you take selfies?
I sometimes do, ironically. The funniest thing to me about anything to do with a camera is I think I'm the least embodied when a camera comes around. Like, I literally feel myself.
Everyone is.
Yeah, that's so weird. It's so weird. As soon as a camera comes in front, I feel some layer of false self come over me, and I'm not like it. Like, literally, I feel my face turn into something else. So I do as little of that as possible. Mm-hmm. Like, my selfies are on the inner self. Inner selfies is what I take.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think anyway, you can't really see the magic of yoga on a picture. You cannot.
No. No.
I really hope people understand that. Like, I really hope that it doesn't, you know, sometimes I'm afraid that it pushes people away from yoga because they think, oh God, I'm not, you know, I'm not a ballet dancer. I can't put my foot behind my head. I'm not skinny, you know.
Well, I think what I'm excited about is also the world is getting more increasingly into meditation. Mm. And I think in the world of meditation, at least as far as I see right now, there's not as much room for that posturing. I say that and then I'm like kind of searching. Can there be? You know, that
can.
There's whenever there's evolution, mm-hmm. there's devolution. And so I kind of think of in the video game of life, mm-hmm. where we are now so far in the yoga journey is that it's just gotten even more, there's more illusion, there's more distraction, there's more different things, and still we can navigate the way through. I really firmly believe in awareness attracts awareness, and intelligence is our nature. And so something will dive through all of that layers of illusion. Maya, it's illusion. It's a fantastic illusion. And it's a fantastic labyrinth to make your way through in order to get to the truth. So I guess maybe now people are smarter, and so they have to work a little bit to find their way through, to sift for the gold.
Yeah, I also believe in it. Yes, you can.
I know
do it.
You do.
Okay, last question. If that would be the last day of your life, what it hopefully not is. So what would be three things you would tell people, humanity, like that you have learned in your life? I know it's a big one.
It's a big one. Well, the first thing that came to mind is, there's three things that came to mind. Love. Laugh. And I don't think death is the end. So this, personally, this meditative fourth state field feels like the wormhole that we move into. And so I sort of find almost excitement and great comfort there. And it makes the temporariness of living like this wild, ecstatic play to play in. It's a field to play in. And that feels abundantly clear to me. Well, less serious, more play. I have the image of Laughing Buddha always in my head. Like, he got it. He woke up and he was like, oh shit. Like,
you mean the belly version of Buddha, or the...
Totally the belly version of Buddha. That's the only one that's laughing.
And it's true. The other one is very serious.
He's like, I got it. Why did I starve myself with a grain of rice? Like, I get it. You don't need to do that. It's all good. Ha ha. I'm going to eat everything. Cake. And my hands are up and I'm fat and happy. Yeah, that one.
Okay, that out. Amazing final last words. So where can people experience Laughing Buddha with you?
Now we're in Paros this September. I will be in Bali teaching a 200-hour. I have a tour of Australia and New Zealand in November. And then we do a 300-hour body mind expression in Bali again. And the in December, January, and then the calendar goes on through 2020. All of our events are embodiedflow.com for Embodied Flow, or my website is tarajudel.com.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
So guys, really go. Go. Like, it's opening up so much in your practice and in your mind and in your life. So really do it. And yeah, we will put everything in the show notes so that you can find the website and everything. And I would love to finish the podcast with singing a mantra with you, Tara. Okay. Your favorite mantra.
Yeah. You'll sing with me.
I sing with you, okay. Yeah. And afterwards, can you say the words? Because people keep asking, like, what does it mean?
Namah Shivaya Parapurnam. Shivoham, Shivoham. Namah Shivaya Parapurnam. Shivoham, Shivoham. Namah Shivaya Parapurnam. Shivoham. Shivoham. Namah Shivaya Parapurnam Shivoham Shivoham. So Namah Shivaya is, I bow to Shiva. Shiva is that effulgent, unified space consciousness who is Para Purnam. Purna is fullness and Para is above. That is above fullness. Para Purnam Shivoham. Mm-hmm. I am that Shiva. I am that Shiva. Mm-hmm. Shiva. I bow to Shiva that is fuller than full. I am that Shiva. Shivoham.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you again, Tara. That was so beautiful. I love you.
Love you.
All right, guys. I hope you took a lot from that podcast as I did and really enjoyed this journey with us. You will find all the information about Tara, her trainings, and where you can practice with her and become a Laughing Buddha in the show notes. And I hope we see us next week. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Vielen Dank fürs Einschalten und Zuhören. Wenn dir diese Folge gefallen hat, freue ich mich, wenn du auch nächste Woche wieder mit dabei bist. Finde alle Infos zum Podcast unter www.vandabhadwa.com, Spotify, Apple Podcast oder deiner Lieblings-Podcast-Plattform. Ich freue mich, wenn du mir folgst, den Podcast mit deinen Freunden teilst und eine positive Bewertung dalässt. Denn nur mit deiner Unterstützung kann der Podcast wachsen und so viele Menschen wie möglich inspirieren. Danke, dass du dabei warst. Ich wünsche dir eine wundervolle Zeit und wir hören uns nächste Woche. Namaste.